Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, the recent fuel protests exposed many issues, one of which was our huge dependence on oil. But Professor Hannah Daly from UCD argues that the answer to this problem is not cheaper oil or more access to fossil fuels, but to take steps to vastly reduce our dependence upon them. Good afternoon, Hannah.
Good afternoon, Sean. Lovely to talk to you again.
You found a certain irony in the fact when Whitegate was blockaded and therefore stymieing our access to fuel.
Yeah, I spent the weekend kind of trying to unpick all the various layers of irony associated with those fuel protests over the weekend. And I wrote about it today for the Irish Times. And I suppose what struck me most wasn't just the protests and how they led to four courts running dry, which is incredibly chaotic. I suppose it exposed how vulnerable we are to fossil fuels and how quickly the system can break down. I suppose the central irony, or the main astonishing thing, is that for weeks we were watching the Strait of Hormuz as this global choke point, and the whole world has been watching with great anxiety as a quarter of the world's oil goes through this central point, and that was shut down as an act of geopolitical power. And then a few dozen, maybe a few hundred tractors and machinery effectively created a version of that here in Ireland. We had our own, mini Strait of Hormuz moment, and that was in fact reflecting the great fossil fuel dependence that we have here, and it was as a result of the oil prices that were created by that geopolitical moment. So we're fragile because of our dependence on fossil fuels at every scale. It's fossil fuels all the way down. The Strait of Hormuz and the Middle Eastern geopolitical problem, that's tied to oil dependence as well. It's not a surprise that a lot of global conflict happens in parts of the world that are oil and gas rich. The same thing happened after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But it's not just the conflicts and the geopolitical aspects of fossil fuels, of oil and gas, but it's also how dependent in Ireland we still here are on those fuels, the vast majority of which are imported, making us very, very fragile.
So I suppose at the same time, it was mostly truckers and farmers who were making these protests. They're particularly dependent on it, and maybe among the general population, of whom many people would have electric cars, not so much.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, these were not irrational protests in some way. Like these businesses that you mentioned, their main input cost is diesel. And that suddenly surged. Like for some businesses, their main input cost doubled. And a lot of these businesses, they can't pass on higher fuel prices. Of course, in the long term, they can, but many of them are locked into, contracts, and they mightn't have hedged their diesel costs. So like a large airline that probably has very kind of long months lot of forward contracts. So it's a bit protected against those fluctuating oil prices. But for a regular trucker, they're buying at the pump like anyone with a diesel car. And they don't have much protection against that. Of course, they should look at their business models and make sure that they are insuring against that. And if we look at our farming system, we're really dependent, or that Ireland's farming sector is really dependent on very small and global commodity markets. So, the typical dairy farmer or beef farmer, they're not selling food locally. They're mainly making very high volume and low margin commodities and selling it on at a price that's set by the global market. So they can't pass on that higher input cost either. So they're genuinely squeezed between a rock and a hard place. So like that vulnerability, it's not accidental. It's actually built into the systems that we have, the land use system and the farming system that we have, that has those characteristics, and the energy system that we have, the transport system that is so diesel dependent. Now, a lot of the kind of the narrative and speculation during the fuel protests was that there is no alternative to that. But I think many people underappreciate how far the alternatives have come. You know, electricity now for trucks is actually a viable solution. And a lot of the critique, I suppose, of high oil prices was placed on the carbon tax. But here's another irony. The carbon tax and climate policy is the thing that's trying to fix the structural cause of the problem, which is our overdependence on fuel. And the irony there is that, you know, by delaying the carbon tax increase, the government may have effectively reduced funding for things like retrofitting or transition in the farming community. So, you know, it's like diverting funds to fix the problem structurally onto sort of a sticking plaster, which is temporarily cutting fuel prices, which does nothing to solve the actual fundamental problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I would imagine truckers or farmers listening is saying, I don't know where you buy an electric tractor.
Yeah, and this is not to, like, you know, tell truckers or farmers that they're to blame here. They're just part of the system, like you and I here. You know, this is not up for individuals to fix. In the same way that, you know, lots of people can't afford to retrofit their houses, you know, just off their own bat. They need support. And that's why we have a big retrofitting program. And there's that option for many people. Of course, it's still out of the hands of many people as well. That's why, you know, the government needs to really look at what are the barriers to electrifying trucks and what supports industries need and provide those. So, you know, I was looking at statistics in China, for example, and now it's very interesting in conversations about climate and energy that but China used to be about their, you know, the growth in coal, but now it is but China is going far ahead of all of the rest of us in renewables and electricity. And one of the most shocking trends, I think, in shocking in a good way for a change, is that sales of electric trucks, now heavy trucks, in China by December of last year overtook sales of diesel trucks. That's how quickly the technology is advancing. And now they're probably ahead, they're way ahead of any other European country. But even the likes of Denmark, the Netherlands, and Sweden, their sales of fully electric trucks are growing very, very rapidly. And even the sales of electric vans and you know, these medium trucks, they're now, they're now almost a majority of new sales. So this is not to say that, you know, the farmer or the trucker is to blame because they don't already have an electric truck. The government needs to put those supports in place, put the charging infrastructure, you know, set the market in place and make sure that those alternatives can actually compete. Because one very important point that was made about the carbon tax is that, you know, if you're just placing on a cost on fuel and if there's no alternatives, then it's just unfair. But, you know, you actually do need to put a price on pollution to make the clean alternatives, you know, to allow them to compete in the market. But at the same time, you need to support businesses to transition. You need to give them finance. You need to give them subsidies. And you need to, you know, have this combination of carrot and stick to make it work.
Yeah. And the infrastructure now, I mean, I know that, like, the carbon tax has become something of a lightning rod among some people, at least. But the lack of infrastructure, it would strike me, is a key factor here. Even if you own a little electric car, where and how can you charge it up? There's just not enough of that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have an electric car. We also have a diesel car, but you know, the electric car, we actually still charge it on a regular 3-pin plug overnight, and it costs a tiny fraction of what it costs the diesel car to charge. It's just incredible. Now, of course, if I want to, you know, do a round trip to Dublin and charge it up again, it'll take some time. But you know, the rapid charging network is evolving quickly. The main, I suppose, barrier that I see to people taking up to buying electric cars at the moment is people who don't have their own driveway at the moment, because electric cars are much, much cheaper to run, but only if you can charge it yourself at your own electricity rate, especially overnight, or if you're lucky enough to have solar panels as well. It's just extremely cheap to run. If you have to rely on the public charging network, then you're looking at a cost that's around about the same as like an efficient diesel or petrol car to run. Now, that was, I suppose, before prices spiked. And so I suppose one of the main kind of policy recommendations that you come out from this is if people want to go electric and insulate themselves from, you know, being dependent on this oil dependency, which hurts us so much, is to give people access to cheaper charging, whether that's at work or in kind of public charging networks that don't cost an arm and a leg. And that's something that could be very proactively looked at over the next couple of months to ensure us, because we honestly don't know how long this oil crisis is going to last. But in the bigger scale, then, when we look at the charging of trucks, it's certainly something that has to be planned for, because these are, you know, very, very large batteries, and they need a lot of access to power. So a lot of investment is needed in providing the grid to do that.
Yeah, well, indeed. Can this be done quickly, Hannah? I suppose, because, I mean, when this whole emergency started, not started by our government, started by a war in another part of the world, that there was a kind of a slight sense of panic of how do we get access to fuel quickly? And that's, a lot of that still seems to be there. The kind of infrastructure you're talking about, the kind of supports to promote all this, how quickly can that be put in place?
Look, realistically, we're not going to turn over the whole truck fleet or the tractor fleet, overnight or even within the next couple of years. But, you know, we know that we have to do it, and the sooner the better. So, you know, I think we can't avoid this fossil fuel crisis, but we can actually make this our last fossil fuel crisis if we put our minds to it. And I suppose the troubling thing is that even though there is national policy to rapidly transition away from fossil fuels, not just because of the climate commitment, you know, and we know how serious that is, but because of energy security and how vulnerable we are to oil dependence, we don't really yet have a serious roadmap and a timeline to do that. And since, you know, this week we have another half a billion euros in cutting fuel taxes, and that adds to fossil fuel subsidies, you know, we have less and less money to actually finance that transition that we have to do. So, you know, I think the best time to start is now.
Yeah. Hannah, thanks a million for speaking with us today. That was Hannah Daly, excuse me, Hannah Daly there, Professor in Sustainable Energy in UCC. I inadvertently changed her place at work earlier on. A few comments on that, as you might imagine. The government makes too much revenue from petrol and diesel. They tout moving away from these fuels, but make no effort to do it. All talk and sound bites. So some text. Well, the carbon tax itself is ring-fenced to go towards helping people retrofit their homes, etc. And the irony, Colin says, and the irony of electric vehicles, example, all the electric Dublin buses parked up because there was nowhere to charge them. So how do we go to trucks and tractors on a national scale? Well, I suppose that certainly speaks to what Hannah was talking about, that need to ramp up that infrastructure and to do it quickly. Someone else says, until the day comes, which I don't believe it will, all agriculture and haulage depends on fossil fuels, even electric vehicles, because our power stations are fossil fueled. We need to go nuclear to become energy independent. Yeah, fair point. Perhaps one that isn't discussed that much. I don't know, maybe it's kind of politically toxic. But even at that, as you understand it, even if today the government made a decision to go nuclear, it would take decades before all that was in place. Can you imagine that on board Panala would be kept very busy when they tried to find a location for said reactor?
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.